It is a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shonyu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teaching, giving meaning to the practice of all of the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. So today's talk is based on a talk of the Dalai Lama entitled Life Impelled by Ignorance. And he begins with the third link, consciousness, which we know as divided into cause consciousness and effect consciousness. And then he just quickly goes over all 12 of them. And it's interesting to notice what he includes and doesn't include. But then he makes some very interesting observations. So basically the talk today is a review, but it has some aspects to it that we haven't heard before. So he starts, that we've already seen, so this is the Dalai Lama, it says we've already seen how the first link, ignorance, motivates the second link, action, which establishes a potency for future experience in the third link, consciousness. So that's in place. Then he explains that in Buddhism, there are several interpretations of the various consciousnesses, but the picture that's usually given to represent the various consciousnesses is a monkey looking in different windows of a house. And so, which is probably posited in the consciousness being only what, there's only one consciousness. So there's one consciousness, but when we see through our eyes, it seems like an eye consciousness, or we have, when we hear something, it feels like an ear consciousness, but actually they're just different facets, like different windows of a single house of consciousness. I've been teaching you this. There's one consciousness with 8 levels, the first 5 being the sense consciousnesses, and then the thinking mind is the 6th one, and then the ego consciousness is the 7th one, and the alaya, the storehouse of all of our behaviors, is the 8th one. So I've also been teaching you that it's all one consciousness, basically. And the Dalai Lama doesn't say much about the 4th or the 5th link, but about contact, the 6th link, he explains that contact is a mental factor. That sort of startled me, actually, that contact is a mental factor that distinguishes objects as pleasurable, painful, or neutral upon the coming together of the object, the sense power, your eyes, and consciousness. So so the objects are visible forms, sounds, taste, etc. Then the sense powers are your organs. And then when an object, a sense power, and a former moment of consciousness acting as the immediately preceding condition, when all 3 of those are present, a consciousness is generated and the mental factor of contact distinguishes the object as pleasurable, painful, or neutral. This is a lot of words to say that contact is a mental factor which distinguishes things. And so this is the beginning. It's the very beginning of our trouble is ignorance. But then in the links, this is the beginning of where things get speeded up And once we're on a roll, we sort of can't stop the roll. So the roll is starting now here with contact and are deciding, oh, I really like that, or I can't stand that, or neutral. That's the beginning. And then feeling, contact is right before feeling, and feeling, the seventh link, is also a mental factor. Feeling is a mental factor and contact is a mental factor. So so the mental factor, feeling, experiences pleasure, pain, or neutral. But the Dalai Lama says that no matter what kind of feeling we have, pleasurable, painful, or neutral, we cannot stay with it. It's very effective and it drives us. Pleasurable feeling generates a strong drive for more, and pain generates a strong drive to avoid. But so that's what the Dalai Lama says. But to me, it feels like because feeling is a mental factor and we can learn to tame our minds, we can be in control, actually. And it's a strong motivator to learn to tame our minds. Many people don't even know that you can tame your mind or have ever even thought of the concept. But in Buddhism, it's done all the time. And I think it's critical. It's critical for us to be in charge of our minds, which if we're not, just go all over the place at all times. So the eighth and ninth link, attachment and grasping, are both types of desire. And the difference between them is that attachment is weaker than grasping. But the Dalai Lama says that attachment too is a mental factor that increases desire without providing any satisfaction. And I'm going to ask you later in the reflection questions if you think that's true, that that attachment is a mental factor that increases desire without providing any satisfaction. And we all get so attached. And I think we're even attached to our attachments. And he's saying that there's no increased satisfaction with attachment. I find that very interesting. So moving on, he just goes right through these. Independence upon name and form, which are our aggregates, that's the fourth one. Sense spheres, contact and feeling, one generates attachment to remain with a pleasurable object and attachment seeking separation from a painful one. When such attachment is produced over and over again in stronger form, this constitutes grasping at the desired sense objects, such as pleasant form, sounds, odors, taste, and so forth. Such attachment and grasping serve to further potentialize or charge up the karmic potency established in the consciousness by a prior action of ignorance, motivated by ignorance. So this causes the attainment of a new life system in the desire realm. When that karma, the predisposition is established in the mind and is nourished by attachment and grasping and becomes fully capable of producing the next lifetime, it's called existence, the 10th link. The picture of the 10th link is a pregnant woman. At this point, the karma that will produce the next lifetime is fully potentialized, though not yet manifest. Analogously, a woman late in pregnancy has a fully developed child inside her womb that has not yet emerged. The 10th link lasts from the time of the fully potentialized karma up to the beginning of the next lifetime. And the 11th link is the dependent arising of birth. And the 12th link is the dependent arising of aging and death. He says there are two types of aging. The first is called progressive, since from the moment of conception, one is always aging. From the moment of conception, we're always aging. It occurs in every moment of our life. I never thought of that before, that every single minute we're aging from the moment of conception. The other type is called deterioration, the usual degeneration of old age. And then after aging comes death. So this is a view of the overall sweep of the 12 links. And he says the 8th and 9th links, attachment and grasping, are where our efforts to change are best directed. But to do this properly, and with full devotion, you need to understand how the whole thing fits together, I think. So then, having given this overview, and so notice that he really gets going with contact and names all of these things as mental factors, and they just increase in intensity. So you can see that once you've identified something as pleasurable, you're almost in the soup. I mean, you're just going to follow your nose. And one of the reasons I'm giving this series is to hopefully we can all just get some awareness going and say, wait, stop. Do I really have to just continue this role? So then the Dalai Lama switches the subject to ignorance as the root of suffering. And we've talked about this, I think, in the earlier lectures in this series. Our lives begin with suffering of birth and end with the suffering of death. And between these two, there are many different consequences of aging and many unfortunate events. This is suffering, the first of the Four Noble Truths, that suffering exists, indeed that our life is suffering. But it's important to investigate, the Dalai Lama says, it's important to investigate whether there's any way to surmount this suffering or not. And so we need to understand this, we need to investigate the causes of our situation. And when we examine any type of suffering, the root is ignorance. As long as we have ignorance, in any and every minute, we can initiate an action that will serve as the cause of another rebirth. Through this process, we have already deposited limitless predispositions in our one stream of consciousness, potencies established by actions motivated by ignorance. We have a limitless number of such potentialities for future lifetimes in our consciousness right now. This is what the Dalai Lama is telling us. And then he says, we have been considering the 12 links of dependent arising. Okay, this is where he blows it all up. So listen carefully. And you don't have to understand it. So I'm going to read this, and then it will boggle your mind, and all you have to understand is that there's no way to understand it like clearly. So we've been considering the 12 links of dependent arising in terms of one round, beginning with ignorance. In this context, we see that other rounds of dependent arising are operating simultaneously, since other instances of ignorance induce additional series. Also, one round of dependent arising requires intersection with other rounds. For example, ignorance, action, and consciousness impel the force producing the next lifetime. But the eighth, ninth, and tenth links, attachment, grasping, and existence, must occur between consciousness and name and form in order to enable consciousness to produce the lifetime indicated by the fourth link, name and form. Also, since the tenth link, existence, represents the fully potentialized karma leading to birth, at the time of that particular birth, another set of name and form, sense, fears, contact, and feeling will be operating. Again, the attachment, grasping, and existence that must come between links three and four must be preceded by their own respective name and form, sense, fears, contact, and feeling, links four, five, and six, and seven. Thus, there's another round of dependent arriving involved in their production. Hence, a single, and this is all you have to remember is this sentence, a single round of dependent arising necessarily involves other rounds. The later links need to fit in between earlier links in order to have all 10 or 12. And so all you need to know is that there's a ton of them going on at the same time, and don't try to figure it out, honestly. A single round of dependent arising necessarily involves other rounds. And there will be multiple other rounds happening simultaneously. So it's just one big, it's not neatly start to finish. It's start and then an intersection and then go in another intersection, another intersection. So then he says, since the first of the 12 links is ignorance and the last is aging and death, there might appear to be a beginning and an end. But since not one, but many sets operate together, there is no end unless ignorance is removed. Until ignorance is overcome, there is nothing one can really do to end this process. And so for us, Soto Zen Buddhists, for us, the implication of this statement is as follows. First, ignorance, which is a misunderstanding about the way we exist, thinking we exist inherently as individuals rather than as an interconnected whole. So the ignorance is a misunderstanding. Seeing the interconnected whole, which is an ultimate truth, requires an enlightened mind. So if we practice Zazen and are careful about our behavior, we can turn the Alaya consciousness into wisdom consciousness, and that will remove ignorance. And it is really clear, therefore it's really clear to us that our practice of Zazen is critical. It's just completely critical. Unless ignorance is overcome, nothing can be done to end this 12 link system. And the way to overcome ignorance is really you could say, if you were a Rinzai Zen student, you'd say to attain enlightenment. But for us, we say to do Zazen, to practice Zazen, because the state of Zazen itself is going beyond ignorance. The state of Zazen itself, whether we know it or not, is enlightenment, actually. As soon as we take this posture, we all already are everything that we think we're striving to be. even though we aren't aware of it. So that was the gift of Dogen. That's what Dogen gave us, that understanding and that certainty. It's certain. And so we Soto Zen Buddhists, in order to overcome ignorance and these, that's the starting the role of many roles at a time of these 12 links, we have to practice Zazen. There's just no getting around it. We're lucky that we know what to do. So that's what we do. If you're, you know, if you're a Christian, you have a very strong prayer life. If you're a Rinzai Zen Buddhist, you attain enlightenment. You strive to attain enlightenment. But Soto Zen Buddhism is no goal Zen. So we just sit. The Dalai Lama spells out. I'm gonna share this with you because it makes everything look really simple. He spells out how we get. So if we consider the 12 links of dependent arising related with a lifetime in a bad transmigration, which would be animal, hungry, ghost, or hell being. In a former life, there was basic ignorance, thinking oneself as existing as inherently independent. And in addition, there was also ignorance with respect to the relation between your action and the result of your action, so that cause and effect. So thinking that wrongdoing, there was ignorance with regard to wrongdoings producing bad effects. So these two were the motivating force producing a non-virtuous action that deposited a potency in the consciousness. And this potency then served as a projecting cause of a life in a bad transmigration. So he goes over this. So then same thing he says, if we consider the 12 links of dependent arising related to a lifetime in a good transmigration as a human, god, or demigod, the basic ignorance is the same, obscuration with respect to our mode of being. But the action that is motivated is a virtuous action beneficial to others, such as abandoning killing. Such a virtuous action deposits in the cause consciousness a good potency for rebirth in a lifetime of high status. This projecting cause was actualized or charged up by attachment and grasping, such that it became fully potentialized as existence, whereupon it produced the projected and actualized effect of a lifetime in a condition of high status. So he kind of goes through, this is how we get to be who we are, using the 12 links. So then the Dalai Lama moves on. He says, reflecting in this same way on how others travel in cyclic existence serves as a technique for increasing compassion. I mean, so we're all sitting here reflecting on, you know, we have to go through all this, but everybody else goes through this too. And so he's saying that it's a technique for increasing compassion, if we think about that. Thus, vast methods of, and there's a lot of methodology around meditations on these 12 links, as the Buddha himself did, whereby a wish to leave cyclic existence is developed. And in terms of reflecting on these 12 links of dependent arising in others, compassion increases. So when we think about or even meditate on these 12 links, we come to, you know, wish we could leave cyclic existence. And then we look at others going through the same thing, and we can cultivate more compassion for others. So far, the Dalai Lama has been speaking of the mode of dependent arising is based on cause and effect. But there's actually two other bases of dependent arising. One is he talks about establishing phenomena based on their parts, and that I think I've talked about this before, that everything boils down to its parts. And so, for example, a human being, you know, we have arms and legs and a head and eyes and ears and nose, but there's no eye there. So we're dependent. So that we're dependent on our parts. So we're dependent on cause and effect. We're dependent on parts. And we're dependent on conceptuality, the conceptuality that fathoms all of this stuff. So he says that in this way, dependent arising comes to mean not just arisen independence on causes and conditions, or imputed independence on the basis of its parts, but also arisen or imputed independence on the conceptual consciousness that imputes the object. And once the object depends on something else, it is devoid of being under its own power. It's devoid of independence. So this is why dependent arising is our truth. And we dependently arise either based on cause and effect, either based on our parts, or based on our conceptuality. It's our conceptuality where the I comes in. But all of it is dependent. None of it is independent. And we think that the eye is, we think all these parts are really dependent on an eye, but so we're all mixed up. He says that nowadays physicists explain that phenomena do not exist merely objectively in and of themselves, but exist in terms of, or in context of, involvement with a perceiver or observer. So even physics is kind of validating this idea of our existing codependently or interdependently and not independently. So then finally, there's a question. Someone asks a question. Don't forget, all of these are lectures that the Dalai Lama has given. And then at the end of each one, I think there's five altogether, there are questions and answers. And I pulled out one that I thought was really interesting. What is the mechanism that stores the predisposition? And how does it travel from one lifetime to the next? So a student of the Dalai Lama asked him that. The answer: the I is designated in dependence upon the mental and physical aggregates. The aggregates are name and form. Body is the form, and then there's four mental ones. My mind is going blank right now. I think I've named them before to you, though. But there's perception, mental formations, and consciousness. I left out the first one. I can't remember. But anyway, they're all mental. So the I is designated in dependence upon mental and physical aggregates. And in terms of the tantric system, there are coarse and subtle levels of these mental and physical aggregates. From the viewpoint of highest yoga tantra, we don't follow this, but this is so interesting. I wanted to read it. The final basis of the imputation of I has to be a subtle aggregate that has been together with oneself since beginningless time. This is a subtle level of consciousness, the continuum of which is beginningless and uninterrupted, eventually reaching fulfillment in Buddhahood. There is no question about whether afflicted minds go on to Buddhahood. Of course they do not. Even the coarse levels of consciousness do not. It is only the most subtle level of consciousness that proceeds to Buddhahood. This subtle level has lasted since beginningless time and continues forever. When we die, our coarser levels of consciousness dissolve. On our last day, at the time of our death, the final consciousness that manifests is this most subtle mind of clear light. It is this consciousness that makes the connection to the next lifetime. In this way, the subtle aggregates necessarily exist continuously throughout time. So I read that to you because I've never heard of any of that. And I don't know that it's in Zen Buddhism, but it's in Tantric Buddhism, and it's very interesting. There's only one more little part here that's a continuation of what I just read in his answer. He says, with regard to the way in which the I appears, there is a general type of I that has existed since beginningless time right through to the present. But with regard to particular I's, there is an I qualified, for instance, by one's own youth, and there is an I qualified by being related to a human lifetime as distinct from another type of life. So he says, for instance, we refer to the I of our own youth. Oh, I used to be such a rascal when I was young, but nowadays I have improved a bit. We talk this way. Many such distinctions are to be made with the I, some general and pervasive, and others more individual and less pervasive. So what I got out of this, he says that there's an I that's existed since beginningless time. It's a general type of I. So I don't really fully understand this. What I got out of it was that we're supposed to have five aggregates, our form and four mental aggregates. So we have five aggregates, and that this sounds like it's another one. It's an extra. There's a deeper, subtle aggregate that comes out in this subtle level of consciousness, and that is what connects us from lifetime to lifetime, and that's what goes on to Buddhahood. What I don't understand about that is what happens to people who aren't. He says that only have coarse consciousnesses. So do they just not have a subtle level, or is it just not alive? I don't understand. Okay, so that's the end of any new material. So the most important points, there are five important points from today's talk. First, dependent arising comes to mean not just arisen in dependence on causes and conditions, or imputed independence on the basis of its parts, but also imputed independence on a conceptual consciousness that imputes the object. So we have three ways we use this term, dependent arising. And the dependency, this is describing the dependent part. Our being is what arises, and we arise dependent on causes and conditions, on our parts, and on a conceptual means of conceiving something. The second important point, no matter what kind of feeling we have, pleasurable or painful, we cannot stay still with it. It is very effective. It drives us. Pleasurable feeling generates a strong drive for more, and pain generates a strong drive to avoid. Third, attachment is a mental factor that increases desire without providing any satisfaction. Fourth, with any one round of the 12 links of dependent arising, there are multiple other rounds happening simultaneously. Last, since the first of the 12 links is ignorance, and the last is aging and death, there might appear to be a beginning and an end. But since not one, but many sets operate together, there is no end unless ignorance is removed. Until ignorance is overcome, there is nothing one can really do to end this process. So remember, he said, we have to think about whether it can be overcome or not, these links, whether we can overcome our suffering. And then he answers that question. The only way to overcome our suffering is to overcome our ignorance. And for that, as a Soto Zen student, we practice Zazen. And also, though, I think we practice Zazen, and in addition, we can start taming our minds, like looking at our preferences, and especially our strong preferences, and seeing how they start this roll toward attachment and grasping, and then, sure enough, a whole new lifetime is created as a result of that. It's mind-boggling, honestly. So here are some questions for reflection during the week. And while we're on this series, it's so theoretical. The time that I bring it back to your own personal life is in these reflection questions. So I truly hope you pay attention to them and really sit with them, because it's where it's at, kind of, in this series. Everything is in these reflection questions. Honestly, I think if you don't really like do the reflection questions, this whole series will go in and out of your head. You know, it'll just be, oh yeah, we study the 12 links. Now, what are they again? And why are they even important? It's the reflection questions where they become part of your own body and mind. So I have five for this week. And the first one is, it's important that starting with contact, the sixth link, and continuing through grasping, the ninth link, that you begin to notice them happening in you. Like, pay attention. Contact creates pleasurable, unpleasurable, or neutral feelings in us. So to notice, just notice. I think I've done this before. I look at my statue here and I immediately have a pleasurable feeling. That's what contact does with my eye, contact. Pleasurable feeling generates a strong drive for more, and pain generates a strong drive to avoid. Attachment is a mental factor that increases desire without providing any satisfaction. So there's no point in getting attached, according to this. And grasping is the same as attachment, only stronger. So that first exercise is watch all those four things happen inside you. Just notice, watch contact creating pleasure, which creates a strong drive for more pleasure, which creates attachment to the pleasure, and then grasping after the pleasure. And pretty soon you create a whole new lifetime of, you know, you've got to do that thing. I used to worry that that would happen with me with a banjo. I thought, this is before I was actually taking banjo lessons, but I always wanted to play the banjo, and I wanted it so much that I thought, you know, I'm going to have a whole lifetime, you know, starting with age two, being given a toy banjo and then just playing the banjo the rest of my life in order to get this desire out of me. I used to think that to myself. And that's, I don't know where I got it, but I used to maybe just noticing how pleasurable feelings lead to attachment, lead to grasping, lead to the next lifetime. Okay, so that's one. That's the first question for reflection. The second, is it true that pleasurable feelings generate a strong drive for more, and that pain generates a strong drive to avoid? Notice occasions of both and modify the previous description to match your own experience more precisely. So instead of saying pleasurable feelings generate a strong drive for more and pain generates a strong drive to avoid, what's a more subtle statement? Pleasure sometimes generates not even a strong drive, but pleasure can generate a kind of interest in something. I want you to come up with something a little more reflective of yourself and your own experience about this statement around strong pleasure is more strong pleasure and pain is just avoid. There must be a subtler understanding in your own experience. So please say what that is. That's that question. And third, is it true that attachment increases desire without providing any satisfaction? Sometimes feeling attached in itself provides at least some sense of satisfaction. Try to describe exactly what happens for you. I'm thinking to myself of my grandparents who married, I think they met on the ship coming over here from Russia, and then they got married. And I don't know that they even knew each other ever, honestly. And so it was just all about attachment. They were attached, for sure. They must have had a deep sense of satisfaction from their attachment. That's what I'm saying. Please question this. So the Dalai Lama said, attachment increases desire without providing any satisfaction. So I'm saying, please question that. That's all. Just please question that. And then the fourth one, describe a situation either in your past or present life where your attachment turned to grasping. When did that happen to you? What are the parts that got more intense? So you're studying yourself. Your attachment turned to grasping. What happened? What part got more intense? Or did something also fall away altogether? What is it that for you personally turns the eighth link into the ninth link? What turns attachment into grasping for you? That's that question. And fifth, once we are sure that we are aware of these links happening in our own daily lives, we need to devise strategies to soften their effects. On the level of contact, for instance, we can at least call ourselves out on developing strong preferences. You know, you can at least go, boy, I really love the statue. Then you can say, I can say, it's a very beautiful statue, and maybe I should give it to somebody so they can have the pleasure of it, and not just I would have the pleasure of it. So I can think like that, to lessen the possibility of my pleasure turning into attachment and then grasping. And also, you can have pleasure without attachment. And so you can experiment with that. When you see yourself getting attached, you can say, there's no reason I need to get attached to this. I could give it away. I could never look at it. I could put it in the closet and pretend I don't have it. There's all kinds of things to just not be attached. So this question is, now that you know that feeling is a mental factor, you can try to tame your feelings, bringing them closer to neutral. And you can learn to have feeling without attachment, and certainly attachment without grasping. Be compassionate to yourselves and to your efforts to become more moderate, because it's hard. And at first it might feel strange. So those are the questions for reflection, and those will all be posted. And they're all about you and your feelings, starting from contact, then to feeling, then to attachment and grasping. And these are the things that the Dalai Lama said is where our best efforts are spent. He said, especially attachment and grasping. I think we can work on contact and feeling also. Well, in the name of time, I think I'll ask if there are questions. I bet there are.
Yes, Kale. The first one that we have is, can you tell me what does taming the mind mean?
You know, I know. That happens to be one of my favorite expressions, because It's so graphic.
If
you use counting your breaths as a meditation device or technique, so you get to two and your mind is already way off, you know, it's almost impossible. It's really hard to count your breaths. I'm pretty much only speaking for myself, but I remember the day when I, you know, noticed that two was about as far as I got. If you tried it, put your mind intentionally on anything, and meditation is a good one, you will see that it doesn't stay there very long. And so you have to keep bringing it back and bringing it back. So in Zen practice, breath counting from 1 to 10, you count the exhales, is a very standard technique. And a lot of times people begin with that, of counting your breath. Suzuki Roshi did that a lot, instructed. Count your breaths from 1 to 10 and then start over. The bringing of it back, the bringing your mind back, that's taming your mind. So, you know, inhale, exhale one, inhale, exhale two. Then then you go back to one, inhale, exhale one, inhale, exhale two, bring it back. And pretty soon you can get to four, maybe. The mind is powerful. It's just powerful. It has a mind of its own. In Buddhism, it's called the monkey mind, which is a very graphic statement of exactly how it is. And we're all that way. That's the thing. We can really be compassionate. We're all that way until we tame our minds. So people who can stay focused, it's really, most people had to work hard to be able to stay focused. It's good when we train, when our children take up a sport, for example, that's a mind training. That's training their minds to stay focused on whatever it is. So it's really good. Ballerinas have exquisite mind training. Just exquisite mind training. And I think any of you who have children should make sure that your children get trained. And it doesn't matter what it is practically, but we need to be able to bring our minds back to what we're paying attention to. I think that explains it. Taming the mind. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. The next question that we have is, give me a second. I'm just opening it up. It's giving me a notification. Okay, so the next one is, can you tell me again that what is karma?
You know, I recently read a little statement by Suzuki Roshi, and he says that, he basically says karma is, he starts out by saying karma is when you do something, there'll be a result. But then he says, it's like tick-tock. It's like tick-tock. It's like time. Karma is time. Karma is time. And it's like tick-tock, cause-effect, 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 cause-effect. That's our life. That's our entire life. Cause-effect. Cause, effect. Every single minute, every single second. And you can think of it as a clock. Tick tock, cause, effect, cause, effect. That is our life. And that's called karma. And sometimes I'll meet somebody unfamiliar with Buddhism and they'll say, oh, I don't believe in karma. Like it's this new age idea that's too radical, or, you know, off somewhere. But it's the most absolute, most, there's no such thing as not believing in karma. If you're alive, then the clock is ticking, basically. And that's what karma is. It's tick tock. And there's a tick, there'll be a tock, period. That's it. That's karma. And you don't have to get any more complex than that. Okay, I don't want to say another word lest I confuse you. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. So there are two more questions. I'll just ask them together and then I'll see if you can answer them together, maybe. So the first one is how can we address and overcome ignorance? And then the last one is, how does what the Dalai Lama says about consciousness relate to what we have learned about karma? They seem to be two different lines of development.
The 12 links describe how we create our suffering. That's why I got so passionate about teaching this series, risking the theoreticalness. I don't like to throw a lot of theory at you, but in the 12 links, the third link is consciousness. And the fourth link are name and form, which are the aggregates of which consciousness is a part of those. Consciousness is an aggregate. So they're basically the same. I think all you need to do is think about the 12 links, and consciousness is included in that, and karma is the second link, really, action. So ignorance creates an action, which is ignorance creates karma, which then creates the consciousness in the third link. And there's also a consciousness as part of the aggregates. I think there are different kinds of consciousness, but all kinds of consciousness are included in either the third or fourth link. So everything in both of those, karma goes back to ignorance, and consciousness goes back through karma to ignorance. Everything goes back to ignorance, and ignorance for us is overcome by the posture of Zazen. And we don't sit Zazen in order to overcome ignorance. We just sit Zazen. That may not make sense to you, but the way it does make sense is that if we sit Zazen to overcome ignorance or to attain enlightenment, we give credence to the I, which doesn't exist. So it's like already doing a false thing in order to do something seemingly beneficial. But a better way of understanding is that Zazen is overcoming ignorance. There's no ignorance. Ignorance doesn't exist in Zazen. So when we do Zazen, we assume a state of being that's beyond ignorance. And that overcomes the 12 links. So for us, it's really clear. We have to do Zazen. There's just no question about it. And I need to stop now. And I want to thank you all for being here. And those of you who are here during the week instead, I thank you for attending then. And I thank my team, Brian and Sahar and Brendan, for what they do. during the week to make these talks possible, and during the talk. Thank you so much. Bye-bye.